This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and our guest is Paul Loeb. He's author of a book called Soul of a Citizen, Living with Conviction in Challenging Times. Paul has been working on citizen engagement since the Vietnam War. He's currently leading a campus engagement project that in 2008 engaged over 500 campuses in 14 states, enrolling 3 million undergraduates. Paul is coming to Chico later this month. He'll be speaking at the Peace and Justice Center Friday evening, September 28th, and keynoting the Butte College Leadership and Civic Engagement Conference on Saturday, the 29th. Welcome, Paul Loeb.
Hey, glad to be here.
You've spent a long time as an activist, 35 years or more, helping others make their activism count. What led you to be engaged in this way in the first place, the 35 years ago, and then how has that evolved over the years?
Well, I started during the Vietnam era, as a lot of people of my generation did, started out supporting the war, as a lot of people did, and had this very famed seventh grade class debate where I said, this is in Los Angeles, I said, the line of the day was, if you don't stop the communists today in Vietnam,
yes,
they'll be on the beaches of California tomorrow. And all the class sort of cheered me on. It was like, yeah, we don't want red tanks on our beaches. And, you know, never mind the Pacific Ocean and how they were going to get there, and, you know, that they didn't have any tanks. And, you know, it just, I was just believing the lies of the time. And then, as other people did as well, sort of started thinking things through and became really critical of the war. And first in high school and then in college, became a student activist. And that was sort of my initial baptism of fire, or whatever one calls it, into social engagement, and I've been active ever since. I mean, a lot of what I've done is to write in books like Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible Will Take a Little While, to write about how ways that people can act and take a stand. And I've witnessed the power that people can have when they get together for change and when they persist, because that persistence really is critical. And I think that's something that we're not very good at as a culture.
Right. So how's that evolved over the years?
Well, I think it's sort of involved and almost circled around in a variety of ways. So there was a long period of time where my primary role was in some sense a chronicler of movements.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be interviewing people who are participating in peace and social justice and environmental movements and telling their stories and drawing lessons from their stories in ways that other people could learn from, and then speaking often to campuses, but not always, about those movements and just kind of how people could act effectively. And then, you know, at the same time, just participating as just kind of a regular participant, for lack of a better word. So if it was a demonstration, I wouldn't be organizing it, but I'd be marching in
mm-hmm.
it, or I'd be knocking on the doors in election time, but I wouldn't be organizing to get out the vote drive. And so that, I would say that was how things were for quite a while. And then in 2008, it shifted where, and by that point, I was already just, I mean, I work a lot with groups, you know, it's the Sierra Club or union groups or Move On, whoever happens to be progressive groups, to sort of do brainstorming on strategies. And so I was doing like a fair amount of that, but hadn't really run my own major project, and then got this project on the elections where I basically recognized that there was so much that administrators, faculty, and staff could do at colleges and universities to get students involved, but that they usually didn't. And so I sort of saw this void and spent a couple of months, this is in 2008, kind of fruitlessly trying to get some of the major higher education groups that I knew to do something, and they just weren't going to do it. They basically were just like, well, we're too busy and it's summer and nothing happens, and all these, to me, pretty lame excuses. And then some of them said, well, we can do something, but we can't take the whole thing on, and that was still helpful and encouraging. And so I just ended up deciding to kind of jump in. I've got some advice from my friend Bill McKibben, the environmental activist,
mm-hmm.
who had started Step It Up, that evolved into 350.org,
mm-hmm.
not that long before. And, you know, he said, just go do it. You know, you can wait forever, or you can try and make it happen.
Right.
And you know, so I just decided to try and make it happen. And it really took off. As mentioned, we ended up working with about 500 campuses in 14 states. And we would pull together resource lists of all the different things that they could do to engage their schools. And I was raising money to hire staffers and give mini grants and that kind of thing, and ended up being a really powerful network. We would walk people through the voting laws in the states, because a lot of these states had, I mean, a lot more now, but even back then, some of them had these pretty difficult and challenging voting laws that you had to navigate right, or else you'd end up not being able to. And so that was what we did, and really worked. And so now we're doing it in, we sort of left the laps in 2010, which was, I think, in retrospect, a real mistake, so I'm not going to make that mistake again. But in 2012, we're just ramping it up, and actually on an even larger scale than we did before.
How did we get to this point where you have to ramp up civic engagement? In the introduction of your book, you talk about low levels of citizen involvement. We've all but forgotten that public participation is the very soul of democratic citizenship, you say. So how do you measure this lack of participation? Not just voting, but there.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I think your first question is really the larger question of how do we, not just how we measure, but how do we get there?
Right.
And what I would say is that when people don't step forward, inertia takes over. And inertia takes over in various ways. I mean, sometimes it just means, like, say, at a campus, that everyone says, well, it's not really my job to get students engaged. Whereas on a campus that's engaged, everyone is doing it. I mean, so, you know, you even have, like, some of our schools, you'd have the football coaches getting the team registered, and then that's not that many people, but they'd parade out at halftime and say, all right, everybody is registered on, you know, every one of these students, and, I mean, unless they're international students or something, you know, every one of them is registered to vote, and you point to the scoreboard, and there's a web link, and now it'll be a QR code this round, to a campus website that basically has the Rock vote registration widget, and boom, you know, everyone's taking responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Every professor is saying, okay, they're going to have a choice to make in their classes. I mean, again, you think California, well, presidential choice, probably going to, we pretty well know who they're going to vote for. But there's initiatives on the ballot. There are, I'm not sure on the geography, but my guess is that within an hour's drive of Chico, or at least of the signal of your radio station, that there's probably some competitive congressional races where people could volunteer. And if they don't want to go drive that far, I mean, and maybe right in the middle of the district, because I don't really know the lay of the land in California, but you know, if they don't want to do that, they can get on the phone and they can plug into one of the phone banks and they can call Ohio or Virginia or Florida, whatever state they want to. And I've done that. And
mm-hmm.
It's interesting because it's been happening long enough over the years that there's a lot of data on this. And basically what they discover is if you make a certain number of phone calls, you will get an additional voter, say, to a list of people who sometimes vote but don't always vote, who are usually the people targeted by the calls.
Right.
They're going to vote for your candidate, and they figure that, you know, by now they'll figure that out. If you make an X number of calls, you're going to get one or two more people to vote. And that may not sound like much, but I remember knocking on doors in my state of Washington in 2004, and that day I got three people out to vote, and one of them forgot it was election day, one of them didn't know what to do with an absentee ballot that late, and one needed a ride to the polls. So it was your classic get-out-the-vote stuff. It didn't depend at all on my being eloquent or convincing or inspiring or anything like that. All I had to do is show up. And
right.
It turned out that the candidate I supported won by 134 votes.
Wow.
5.5 million. 134 votes is nothing.
Right.
And I realized, I just did the math. I thought, okay, well, I accounted for three votes. And actually, I was doing stuff by phone or the rest of the week, so I'm sure I accounted for more than that. But just on that one day, if 50 fewer people had shown up to volunteer, or 50 more on the other side of getting out their base, then you would have had a different governor. I mean, in Florida in 2000, leave aside all the other garbage that they, you know, that shifted that election in Florida, but nonetheless, the official total was, 536 votes or something like that. So, again, you could have 100 volunteers or 200 volunteers, and they could be people maybe calling from California, and that could have tipped it. I'm not quite sure if the phone banking technologies were quite as advanced at that point. I don't think they were.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but nonetheless, if they'd been in-state, and now you can even do it from another state, that stuff matters. I mean, there's an election that I haven't spent on the phone the couple weeks before, just as much time as I've got, plugging into one of those phone banks because that's what you need to do. And, you know, in fact is, my project, the way it works, because we're working with infrastructure at schools and administrators, faculty and staff, by a week before the election, it's going to pretty well be done for me. So I'll probably just be on the phone like anybody else, just trying to get those one person at a time out to vote.
I wonder if we could back up just a little bit and talk history, and particularly
sure.
the perception of a decline.
Yeah, because that's the original question.
That's okay. The answer was good.
Yeah.
But there was the silent generation of the 50s and 60s, which was followed by the Vietnam group. And I, in seventh grade, learned about Greek participatory democracy, though I have to say I'm a little skeptical of that notion now in terms of its level of engagement. But where did the decline or the perception of decline come from?
Well, I think the decline came from a number of things. I mean, you know, some of it's a little mythologized. So if you look at, say, campuses, and they think, you know, or the Vietnam generation, they pick 1968 and pick 1969, 1970 as a level of involvement, and they forget that, I think it was 1966, a majority of the students at University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is as active and radical
mm-hmm.
campus as
yes.
existed,
yep.
supported the war. So, you know, it wasn't quite, you know, it wasn't the whole decade. It was key couple of years. So one is a standard comparison. But I do think that there's a lot of forces that make it harder. I mean, one is people are working more hours. I mean, if you're a student, you're burdened down by way more debt. I mean, I graduated, in fact, actually, two different private schools. As I was an activist at Stanford, got kicked out for my activism and ended up in New York at the New School. So private school tuition, I was able to do that with a 20-hour job as a bartender. And cover
right.
that cost. Yeah. There's no way you could do that today,
no.
not even close. So, you know, the sheer economic pressures of having to work more hours, of being further in debt, I think, I mean, they should be an impetus to act, but for sure they can also grind people down. I think, you know, just the commutes, the driving time, and the decline in which Robert Putnam has a famous book called Bowling Alone, where he talks about how people used to bowl in bowling leagues, and then it shifted to just bowling in individual, you know, one or two friends, with as many people bowling as ever did. And he was looking at the decline of those, everything from unions to PTA participation to the Elks Club and the Rotary and just all those sort of civic institutions and how many fewer people participated. Now, his big culprit was TV, that basically you could factor out for all the other variables, some of which definitely had an impact. But the fact is, the more time people watch TV, the less time they do anything else. Now, that book came out, the article came out about 15 years ago, and the book came out maybe 10. But so now, you know, TV is supplemented and partly replaced by our online world. And that's very double-edged because it's clear it can be a tool for mobilization. I mean, any movement around from the, you know, 08 Obama campaign to the Tea Party relies, you know, significantly on those technologies to get the word out.
Right.
At the same time, it's, you know, and it can be very effective. At the same time, you really can fall into what I call the seduction of clicking, this is the phrase I use in Soul of a Citizen, where you believe that all you need to do is click and things will change, and that just doesn't do it because you need to have those face-to-face conversations. And so if it facilitates them, it's great, but if it drives them out, it's not so great.
I just wonder how you assess the level of, you personally, how you assess the level of civic engagement now. What do you think is going on with people right now in terms of their civic engagement? You talk about the positive things you're doing to create greater civic engagement, but where are we now with that?
I think it's a complicated picture. So let me finish one more thought on the virtual side and then flip over.
Okay, sure.
So one example is MoveOn did this kind of phone banking with its members in 2006. And they had, I can't remember what it was, it's in Soul of a Citizen, but I think it was something like 150,000 people participating. And they really figured out, actually, this is how many votes it secured. And it was a lot, but it was like 5% or 3% of their membership. And then they did one-on-one phone calls, member to member. And obviously there are a lot of other factors in 08, but it jumped about half their membership participating. So the lesson to me was, it's nice to send the emails, but if you don't follow up by phone, it's not going to happen. So getting back to the other question of just how people do participate, I mean, I think that part of what we have to do is just to recognize that you almost have to rebuild community even as you're trying to engage it. I mean, in Soul of a Citizen, I use the example of this, my closest friend who's a commercial fisherman and an environmental activist named Pete Knutson. And I've watched his work with the salmon fishing community. He fishes in Alaska during the summers and off Washington State during the fall and spring. And basically, he's creating this community of people who are pretty isolated, and then he's working to engage them in environmental issues. And you almost have to do both at once, almost whatever kind of environment you're in. That seems part of the task these days.
You are a storyteller, and you believe very much in the power of stories. You've just told us one. I wonder if you could share one or two more from the book of people
Sure.
who make a difference.
Well, one of the stories in Soul of a Citizen that I often tell is the Rosa Parks story. And it may seem like an odd choice because it's a story that everybody thinks they know. But I open the book with it precisely because people don't really know it, and they think that here's this woman who came out of nowhere and suddenly miraculously changed history single-handedly, acting all on her own, and almost on a whim because her feet hurt. And it's just simply not true. There's this whole community that she was part of. She was the secretary of the NAACP for a dozen years. She took trainings at a place called Highlander Center, a labor and civil rights center that's still going in Tennessee. I mean, it wasn't just the sort of, one day I'm going to make history. It was part of this long process, and it involved a whole lot of other people. And there was a guy named E.D. Nixon, for instance, who was a labor organizer with a Sleeping Corps Porters Union that took the bags on the train, and historically black union. And he was the one who got Martin Luther King involved. You know, we think of King as, of course he was stepping forward from the get-go, but he had all these excuses. I mean, he was just like every reason in the book. He was young, he was new in town. I mean, they're mostly true. But fortunately, Nixon prevailed and dragged him into engagement, or else maybe the world would never have heard of Martin Luther King. And so what I use that to is just sort of to contrast the difference between a context where people are acting on their own and the fact that there is always a community of engagement. So that seems very just a really important lesson. The other thing is that we, with Parks, that it's not accidental, it's intentional when we act. And so she had taken these training sessions, she'd strategized, and basically she knew what she was doing. She knew she was going to trigger a particular battle in an ongoing movement. And that's really important because that's when you're acting, you're trying to figure out how do you tell your story? How do you gather allies? How do you pull people in? How do you get past the obstacles? It doesn't happen randomly. Now, it doesn't mean you have to know everything. One of the traps that people have is, I call it the perfect standard, where they feel like they need to know every single fact, 17th decimal point statistic to act. But that doesn't make sense. But it just means you go ahead with what you know. You then figure it out as best you can, and you take a stand. So that's just, to me, it's a story we all know, but we don't know it right. And then I talk about the need to persevere, and again, Parks continuing 12 years from her first NAACP meeting to stand on the bus, and another 10 years till the Civil Rights Act is passed. And again, part of the challenge is to recognize that when you're getting somebody involved, say it's in this election campaign, and you're working to get them involved, and maybe your candidate wins, and maybe your candidate doesn't win, but they go on to do all these powerful things. I mean, this is true in Parks' case, where her husband was the founder of the NAACP in Montgomery. He was just a barber, regular person, Raymond Parks. We know he helped get her involved. We don't know how he got involved. Somebody along the line helped get him involved, and then he helped set the chain in motion. So to me, that's a critical story to understand. There's a young woman I write about in Soul of a Citizen in the new edition was a student at Virginia Tech named Angie DeSoto, and she was not the most politically engaged person. She described their first election, which was in 04, and she was a freshman, and she said I didn't think who was president had any impact on my life, so I didn't vote. And then she got really more embarrassed and described a drinking game where they lined up with red and blue teams, and the red team would chug a beer when the red state turned red, and the blue team would chug a beer when the state turned blue, and you know, they were completely, by the end of the evening, didn't even know who was running for office. And so this is where she starts, but she gets involved in climate change because a professor took the risk, it was a geology prof, took the risk of basically talking about it in the class, and she didn't know about it. So she starts learning. She gets involved in this tiny campus environmental group. And Virginia Tech has 25,000 students, and this is maybe a five-person group. And it turns out that she's a really good organizer. And so she works for the PERGs in California, CalPERG, and one of their initiatives. Her aunt lived in Sacramento, so she was staying at her aunt's house and working with CalPERG over a summer. And she said the lesson was, I knocked on 20 doors, 20 people would say no, the 21st person would thank me, and that would make it all worthwhile. And she takes that approach, that persistence and that systematic approach, back to the school, and she ends up growing the campus group into the largest student group of any kind on this campus, political or not, 1,300 members. And she then pushes through this major sustainability initiative, which the president ends up backing, and she's now running it. They, even with a budget crisis, they figured a way to hire her and keep her on. And I love what she said. She said, I'm proof that institutions can change, that I'm proof that individuals can change, and this school is proof that institutions can change. I started out as a drunken party girl. Mm-hmm. This place was a very apolitical campus. Now both of those are no longer true. So, you know, what a less inspiring lesson, because you just don't know. I mean, if that one person from the environmental group hadn't approached her, if that one professor hadn't talked in his class, you would not have this really, really powerful activist who's going to go on to do all sorts of other amazing things in her life, and, you know, already has at age, whatever she is, 25, 26.
You're talking about civic engagement at all kinds of levels. We have problems with voter turnout, even if it's something that people can see affects them directly, they don't vote. But you're talking about civic engagement from everything from voting for the president, which a lot of people don't bother to do, to doing something at your college, which of course you do a lot of, to doing small things in your community. Maybe you can just talk about how big this area of civic engagement can be and how there might be things that we just haven't thought of that we could participate in.
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting challenge of how you balance the local and the national, the local and the global. And to me, what I always try to do is to figure out a way to work locally in a way that potentially creates national traction. And so, you know, or at least on some larger level. And, you know, maybe by doing some really innovative pilot project. I mean, so I'll just give you one example, which is, there's a friend of mine, I mean, Chico's probably too small to have one, but there's a friend of mine who started one of the street newspapers that people who are homeless or near homeless sell in Boston. And it was a model that basically hadn't really been developed very much, but he set it up, got it working, and kind of a good thing because you had a combination of the vendors got to make money. They said they keep three-quarters of the dollar, and then the quarter of it goes to help defray the expenses of the organization, and the newspaper has good content. And then when he moved to Seattle, he started one called Real Change that I've been on the advisory board of for a while. And now there's, I can't even remember, but there's probably like 60 or so in the United States, as well as a bunch of them internationally. And so, you know, that was a case where they developed a model, and it was a really powerful model that could then be replicated. So that was a local action. But I would argue that it had implications beyond Boston or Seattle. And I think, you know, that some of the sustainability initiatives, the same thing is true. And, you know, you take, I mean, again, what was Angie doing? I mean, on the one hand, she was helping significantly reduce the carbon impact of a You know, a 25,000 person school is a pretty big school, and that's important. But she was also creating a model for other schools, for other institutions. I mean, I remember, like, in South Carolina, which is, you know, not the most liberal state by a long shot.
Right,
but,
right.
They had a, it was a new residential living learning dorm. And basically the guy in charge of, I guess it was plants and facilities or whatever it is, at buildings and grounds, in charge of putting it together, decided to make it as green as possible. And he didn't have any additional budget. He just sort of had to innovate. But, he, you know, he consulted with all the people he could think of. And, I mean, some things, very simple things like garbage disposals were all, you know, were fairly costly when you're doing them on, you know, in every single unit. And were always breaking down. They were just a real pain in the butt. So by just eliminating them, he had, I don't know, whatever it was, $50 or $70 per unit that you could then apply to other things like a super efficient heating system and stuff like that. And somehow managed to make it really significantly more efficient in every possible energy use for roughly the same cost. And then what happened is that the architecture school had no training program for sustainable architecture, but they sort of saw it and kind of started thinking about it more and started a program. And the legislators had a, it was Columbia is the capital of South Carolina, so they saw it and they thought it was really cool, and they pushed through a mandate for state buildings over a certain size. I think it was lead silver. I mean, it wasn't anything hugely dramatic, but compared to what it was, you know, some level of sustainability. And it was all from that one building. So, I do think that things can really be models. At the same time, you know, and again, I'm thinking of climate change that I work a lot on, you have to have global responses. You have to have national responses. And so, you know, at some point or another, this country has to stop funding oil exploration and start seriously invest, or not start, but ramp up seriously investing in renewables more than it has. You know, now, again, I'm just, you know, to go back to the local, when that, you know, the Obama administration just passed the mileage, or not, or stipulated the new mileage plan.
Right.
You know, part of the reason for that was that made it easier is California, with this huge car market, mm-hmm. had already been doing it, and so sort of paved the way. I mean, it's the same thing as, well, we have a medical marijuana, a non-medical, a general marijuana initiative in our state, in Washington, on the ballot. We hope it'll pass. I mean, California's didn't in part because, you know, I think some sloppiness in the law, and then what to me was kind of a sad testament to the Humboldt County and Sonoma County and the marijuana counties voting against mm-hmm. it from what I would consider narrow self-interest.
Exactly.
Which is pretty ugly. We have some of the same problems, you know, here with ours. So you can have something that's a model, and then other states can apply it, or in this case, states can use it to push back against the federal laws. So I think there's a constant interplay, you know, between the local and the national or global. And you just have to push on multiple levels. You know, but I would argue, though, that in an election year where so many things are going to be decided, that I just urge people to take some time. It really isn't that hard. I mean, you know, I'm not going to tell them who to vote for, but to get on, you know, go down to those sites and sign up and make some calls to some other states where, you know, the result really could be 100 votes or 300 votes. I mean, I know that, I mean, I remember it was in 06 I was calling, was it Virginia and Missouri that had close races? And they were really, really, in Montana, they were really, really close races. And I was just glad that, I mean, I know that in the course of, I don't know, the last couple of weeks, that, you know, between all those states, you know, I probably got 50, 60, maybe 75 people, you know, who wouldn't have voted otherwise. You know, because I heard the arguments, well, it's not going to matter, I'm tired, this and that. And you just kind of persist. And, you know, that doesn't sound like that much, but, you know, when you have 100 or 200 or 300,000 people or 500,000 people doing it, then all of a sudden that's a whole lot of voters. So I just really urge people to at least at some part of what they're doing, try and plug in, even if it has to be virtually, and then figure out. And, again, I don't know. There very well may be a close congressional race that's not at all far from Chico. I mean, I don't really know the map of them. And plug into that however you can. Because, I mean, I think this is, you know, it's one of those moments where it, what we do can make this, I don't know how to describe it, elections are linear. I mean, if you get, you know, on presidential level, you know, one more vote in those key states, that's who's elected president, that's who elects the Supreme Court justices, that's who makes, you know, decisions on everything from, you know, gay rights to immigration to tax policy. I mean, it's hugely consequential. And that's a linear strategy, either for change or holding the line on change. And then complementing it is the much less linear strategy that we do all the rest of the time, which is how do you create a movement that's strong enough and cohesive and durable enough and includes enough powerful voices so that the elected leaders are compelled to listen to it. I mean, the example that I use it in Soul of a Citizen, is the civil rights movement with Lyndon Johnson, because Lyndon Johnson was a supporter of the civil rights movement personally. That is, he shared the values, and he did modest things all along the way when he was in the Senate to try and help. But when that movement was coming to the forefront in the early 60s, he saw it also as a real political risk, because a lot of the Democratic base was in the South, and he was afraid that they would walk if he pushed too hard. And so there was a very famous convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, in 1964, where Johnson was browbeating Martin Luther King, and Walter Reuther, who was the head of the United Auto Workers, that had been a big civil rights backer, and pleading, but alternately sort of pleading with them and threatening them to get them to convince the integrated Mississippi Freedom Party delegation to back off and not participate and not push to be seated, because he was afraid it would split the convention. And he was in the wrong morally on that, as far as, you know, from my perspective, even though I understand the motives. But then what was interesting is that the civil rights activists didn't back off. They kept on pushing. And Johnson then shifted and put all his massive political skill and massive political capital on the line to pass the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. And so, to me, that's a real example of, you know, here's the power of the movement to influence a president. At the same time, if Barry Goldwater had been elected in 64, who was avowedly opposed to the Civil Rights Act, I don't even think he was particularly racist. I actually have some respect for Goldwater, but he was just, you know, he was just like kind of a states' rights fundamentalist in some ways. And, you know, he would not have gone along with that. He would not have supported it. If this, not only wouldn't he have lobbied it, he probably would have vetoed it. So, you know, it's a case of a movement complementing an electoral strategy. And I think that's really important to understand that the two can play together. I mean, that's where I think in some ways, I mean, Occupy was facing huge challenges, I think had a significant impact. I hope we'll sort of, you know, morph into something that continues to do. But by being so anti-electoral, it's different from saying, okay, this is where I'm going to put my prime energy is figuring out a creative way to go to cheap J.P. Morgan Chase or Wells Fargo and illustrate the what they're doing for the housing crisis. But when they're sort of not only doing that, which is great, but sort of saying, well, I'm just going to turn my back on the electoral sphere as well, entirely because it's all corrupt, you know, I think that's a strategic mistake. I think you act in different ways, but then you act maybe at a lower level in some other ways that complement it. So to me, that's the challenge.
I was going to ask about the Occupy movement, because it seemed to me that at the outset it had a lot of force. It had a lot of national involvement. It had involvement from, for example, farmers. We've interviewed Jim Garrettson a couple times, who came to Farmers Occupy. And I think that there were a lot more segments of the society that I thought were going to take hold of this and move it toward legislative issues or judicial issues. And why do you suppose that didn't happen, or will it happen?
Well, I think it still has some potential. I mean, so here's my sense of it. You know, and it's complicated. I think it definitely had an impact. I mean, sometimes very tangibly. I mean, in New York State, the governor, Andrew Cuomo, basically was against keeping the millionaire's tax, which was the progressive tax that New York had. And it was Occupy that shifted him. And, you know, it was the pressure that they created. So, again, a very tangible gain. You know, he was somebody who at least was somewhat beholden to progressive constituencies. And when they put that massive pressure on him, he shifted. So you know, just, you know, on that level. And I mean, I remember they did research on, like, the mentions in the media of inequality and concentration of wealth. And they just shot up after the Occupy movement. So all of a sudden, all these major media mainstream sources were talking about inequality and looking at it and flagging it for the crisis that it is. So, you know, definitely had an impact. But then why did it fall short so far? I think a couple things. I mean, one is, I mean, it was a movement that was physically centered on those occupations and didn't think creatively enough, in my view. I mean, it was tricky because it was also coinciding with in most of the country with winter coming on, where even if you're allowed to stay outside, you're going to basically freeze, you know, in much of the country. But they didn't think creatively. I think they got so fixated on holding the physical space. I know this certainly seemed true in Seattle, that they didn't figure out a creative way to say, okay, all right, say, you know, they say we can't camp out on this space. Let's figure out a creative way to reassemble every single day with a presence, and then break it down at night, so that we're there as a gathering place, but they can't enforce a no camping ordinance against us. You know, so just on, you know, sort of very basic practical. That was part of it. I also think that the strength was a couple of things. One is direct truth telling about the situation of people who were on the short, you know, who've been just destroyed by this economy. Mm-hmm. Very, very powerful. The other was sort of what I would call creative acts of theater style witness. I mean, so a lot of the kinds of things that were done at the banks really caught people's imagination, mm-hmm. and that was great. But I think that at some point, and maybe this had, in my view, its origins in some of the limits of the politics. I mean, if you look, for instance, I mean, I like the publication Adbusters. That was fairly influential. Mm-hmm. But it's about sort of political theater. That's the heritage that comes out of it. It doesn't come out of a political organizing tradition. I think that, you know, that sort of power of visual arts and of creative statements is huge. But at the same time, it can't do everything. And at some point, you got to do the door knocking. You've got to build the coalitions. You've got to be working together. Now, that's not to say that some of that has happened. I mean, I have a friend who's been working with Occupy Chicago. And in Occupy Chicago is interesting because it's sort of morphed into a kind of labor community coalition that, in fact, is targeting concentrated wealth. But they're doing it in alliances with groups like major unions that have a significant power and a significant actual base. And they aren't just dependent on who happens to randomly show up, so they've got people they can reach out to. And I think it makes it much stronger. And to me, that's what has to happen going forward, whatever happens in the election. I mean, I know that there's been, I don't actually know where it all led. There was a lot of nonviolent civil disobedience training this late spring. And I actually haven't really seen huge actions coming out of it. But I think, and maybe they don't really have to happen now. I mean, unless people come up with some great creative things that can simultaneously highlight some of the electoral issues and the deeper issues. But I think that they, you know, this is not to diminish what Occupy accomplished, because it was very important. I mean, I think it shifted the dynamic. It pushed the discussion in ways that it needed to be pushed. But at the same time, I think in terms of an organizing model, it had its limits. You know, it also ended up evolving, at least certainly in my city of Seattle, into the situation where, because the meetings took so long, and because that original mechanism of call and respond and echo the words that was kind of a, I don't know, I mean, it was a sort of mechanism of almost happenstance from not having bullhorns, that then turned into something that's sort of like this shining grail, that this is a key part of who we are. And sometimes, in some ways, it could be very powerful. And in some ways, to my mind, it could be totally dysfunctional, because it just dragged on the meetings and it dragged on the assemblies until basically people who had jobs and kids left, and you ended up with a kind of most footloose and marginal people who had the fewest ties to communities. And it's not that those people shouldn't be part of it, but it's just that if you're going to build a broad movement, you've got to have people with ties to existing communities. And if they're going to not be able to put up with a four-hour meeting, then you got to figure out some other way to involve them. So I guess I don't want to sound too critical of it, but those would be the issues that I would raise.
Yeah.
The Occupy movement had a huge and diverse agenda. And I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about overlap of purposes. As you'll see when you're here in Chico later this month, we have a very vigorous activist community, but often we work at somewhat cross purposes. We have a bunch of environmental organizations, a bunch of social justice and civil rights. And at this point, we're also all competing for diminishing funds just to stay afloat.
No, it is. It's. I think too often we don't do that. I mean, we end up competing. I mean, I had this, really ugly thing that happened in Seattle where a major youth engagement group that does really good work basically sort of tried to knife me behind my back to donors because they wanted to have all the territory. And it was just like, that's just wrong. And they were doing good work. But it was like, no, that's not the model. We need to work together.
Exactly.
And, I'm working a lot with Rock the Vote on my project and the student PIRGs. And, in fact, I just did a training for the PIRGs, the West Coast Organizer Phone Conference, right before this call. And, we're working together. You have to have that. I mean, if we're fractured, we lose. So you just somehow people have to figure out how to get beyond their particular egos, their particular belief that their solution is the only best solution, and to recognize that it's a broader ecosystem and it all complements each other. That's our challenge. I mean, and it's been a historic challenge for progressive movements, but we have to figure out how to do it. Because, I mean, ultimately, honestly, you believe we're a majority of the country, but only if we actually act and coordinate and then get people talking to other ordinary people. I mean, that's key. You can't do it kind of cleaving together with the sort of core converted. It just doesn't work. So, I mean, one of the huge messages of Soul of a Citizen is just you got to reach out and you got to bridge beyond your core boundaries.
We have just a minute or so left here.
Yeah, because I'm going to have to run.
I know you have to go. I just so maybe you could just answer this quickly. If all of the cynics and all of the people have lost hope, we're sitting at your feet right now, and I know that your optimism is very impressive and inspiring to me. But those people that, including some people who were involved in Occupy, if those people who've said it's not going to work, if you had just a few words to say to them, what would you say?
Well, I would say that we never know. That if we look at history at any single point, this is a big message of Soul of a Citizen and my other book, The Impossible, will take a little while. At any point in history during social change movements, you could look and you could say, yeah, it's not going to work. I mean, we're just up against too much. I mean, I remember going to Susan B. Anthony's the suffrage movement, her little museum in her former house. And, she died before women got the vote. But obviously what she did was part. So you just have to, understand that you never know the timetables of change. And when people step up and they persist and they keep on going, history does erupt unexpectedly. But it's always that work beforehand that lays the ground for it. I mean, that's why I go back to that Rosa Parks story. I mean, those 12 years that Parks worked with the NAACP before the Stand on the Bus, they were not wasted time. They were seeding the ground, building the infrastructure, building the community. So then when one particular action ended up leaping, that's when things could change. And visibly change. But everything else led the way. And we just have to think in those terms and keep thinking creatively and keep reaching out and keep broadening our alliances. And that's how change will come.
We want to thank you, Paul Loeb, for talking with us and being genuinely inspirational.
My pleasure.
I just want to mention that you'll be in town the 28th and 29th of this month at the Peace and Justice Center and out at Butte College. Also, the book is Soul of a Citizen. And Paul has a website, www.soulofacitizen.org. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.